Our scripture reading this morning is from Numbers chapter 13, verses 25 through 33. When they returned from spying out the land at the end of 40 days, they proceeded to come to Moses and Aaron and to all the congregation of the sons of Israel in the wilderness of Paran at Kadesh. And they brought back word to them and to all the congregation and showed them the fruit of the land. Thus they told him and said, "We went into the land where you sent us, and it certainly does flow with milk and honey, and this is its fruit. Nevertheless, the people who live in the land are strong, and the cities are fortified and very large. And moreover, we saw the descendants of Anak there. Amalek is living in the land of the Negev, and the Hittites and Jebusites and the Amorites are living in the hill country, and the Canaanites are living by the sea and by the side of the Jordan." Then Caleb quieted the people before Moses and said, "We should by all means go up and take possession of it, for we shall surely overcome it." But the men who had gone up with him said, "We are not able to go up against the people, for they are too strong for us." So they gave out to the sons of Israel a bad report of the land which they had spied out, saying, "The land through which we have gone in spying it out is a land that devours its inhabitants, and all the people whom we saw in it are men of great size. There also we saw the Nephilim. The sons of Anak are part of the Nephilim, and we became like grasshoppers in our own sight, and so we were in their sight."
Personal disorders have become quite in vogue today. It seems that everyone has a complex or two. You're an introvert or an extrovert, or you're paranoid or schizophrenic, or there are a number of things that have been analyzed and scrutinized. Probably they never been analyzed through the centuries because we never got around to the names for them, perhaps. But they've been identifiable, and there's an interesting study as people go back and look at historical figures and attach various names to them and complexes. But here this morning, as we look at this particular text in Numbers, and we're looking at the conclusion of our series, really, on the children of Israel from Egypt, we're going to leave them right outside the promised land here this morning. That we look at the various stages in which they've come and the events that have occurred to them and the spiritual lessons that apply. But here we see for them this morning that they themselves have a complex. And this is a complex that we were going to refer to this morning as grasshopper eyes. It is a grasshopper complex that they had. You know, it can, and if it happens to you or to me, or it can paralyze us spiritually and it can interfere with our walk with God. Now, the 12 spies were sent out by Moses here in the fourth part of this chapter to spy out the land. And the song that we sang earlier this morning, that on Beulah land, is the expression of that promised land. Beulah land is the title that's given to that particular piece of land in one part of Scripture. But they were to view out that land, and of course, 10 spies came back, and they said that it was an impossible task that lay before them, that the land could not be gained, and they were intimidated by the project. And verse 31 here, Numbers 13. "But the men who had gone up with him said, 'We are not able to go up against the people, for they are too strong for us.'" But there were two spies who then begged to differ with the assessment of the other 10. And we see that in verse 30 here. "Then Caleb quieted the people before Moses and said, 'We should by all means go up and take possession of it, for we shall surely overcome it.'" Now, what we find out is one of those things that happens sometimes is that the majority ended up just making the decision here. The one thing that we will see from this passage, and that we have watched it as we've gone along with the children of Israel and traveled the adventures that they have had from the time that they have left Egypt up to now, is the majority is not always right. In fact, the majority is seldom right when it comes to spiritual decisions. And we see that as here in this chapter, the first four verses of Numbers 14. It says, "Then all the congregation lifted up their voices and cried, and the people wept that night. And all the sons of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron, and the whole congregation said to them, 'Would that we had died in the land of Egypt, or would that we had died in this wilderness. And why is the Lord bringing us into this land, to fall by the sword? Our wives and our little ones will become plunder. Would it not be better for us to return to Egypt? So they said to one another, let us appoint a leader and return to Egypt. The majority decided that that's what they wanted to do, that at least they were not going to go and capture the land. They decided that that was not within the realm of possibilities for them. But notice the exaggerations that they had here about all this. In verses 32 and 33 of chapter 13, so they gave out to the sons of Israel a bad report of the land which they had spied out, saying, the land through which we have gone in spying it out is a land that devours its inhabitants, and all the people we saw in it are men of great size. There also we saw the Nephilim, the sons of Anak, part of the Nephilim, and we became like grasshoppers in our own sight, and so we were in their sight. Now, you know, truly, if they were giants in the land, and we know that certainly it is no trouble for a giant to step on a grasshopper and kill the grasshopper. But there are several reasons why here that the children of Israel had adopted this grasshopper complex. Now, the first reason is that the Canaanites were better armed. They had horses and they had chariots and they had found out how to process iron. And so they had made a weaponry of iron. This is, we find in the pages of Scripture, their relatively new development as far as man is concerned in learning how to do that. But they had all these things. Besides, they were a well-trained army. And the reason why they were a well-trained army is because from their very existence, they fought all along. And so they knew how to fight, and they knew how to go to battle, and they knew how to be organized. And of course, this is territory that was entirely new to the nation of Israel at this point in their existence. Another reason was because of they had walled cities. And they were going to go up against these walled cities, and they were living in tents. Now, it doesn't take but a couple of men to hold on to a part of a wall. But it takes several hundred to try to take that wall from him. And so they right away saw that there was an obstacle here when they tried to go up against these walled cities and try to capture it. And then a third thing that seems to be alluded to here in this passage in verse 32 in the last part of it, it says, we saw in it men of great size. Well, from what information that we have, that the Canaanites were a people that were a little bit taller than the rest of the people in that area. And so they were just physically, they were larger people. And so they saw these obstacles in their way. But what they didn't see is that simple faith in God would shift the military balance of power. And that was not something that they had even entered in this equation for the spies or for the rest of the nation of Israel. It's always easier to see the giants than it is to see God. And we tend to revise downward our estimate of God's faithfulness and power. That we begin to think in practical terms about how God will work when God is an impractical God from that standpoint. That His whole purpose in working in lives and accomplishing things is do that beyond that which we can set down and figure with a pen and a pencil and a slide rule and a calculator, that God is far beyond all those things. But time and time again, our experience is that we want to see how God will operate by using all those various elements and bringing them into play and never allowing God, of course, to do what He can do on His own. The grasshopper complex, whenever we turn away from a God-given challenge for fear that we lack the resources to tackle it. The 10 spies here caught a bad case of the grasshopper complex, and the virus then spread throughout the whole multitude of people. Moses wanted a simple report on the land. That's why he sent the 12 spies in. And he got this fruit of fear. And became a very destructive influence of a bad example here is that we cannot take the land. Well, let's take a moment to look at some of the characteristics here of the grasshopper complex, because I think that we will find that the grasshopper complex is something that still remains alive today. Perhaps it has not been as analyzed as some of the other types of disorders, but it is a very real complex today. The first thing that we see here with the grasshopper complex is that of a doubting heart. That this vocal majority could only think of all the reasons why it would fail. They could see why they could not win, why they could not be accomplished. Does that sound familiar? Just about any group of people, any organization that I've ever been with, that the first thing that they begin to look at is all the reasons why it'll fail, rather than the reasons and the positives of what would happen if we should succeed. But verse 31 of chapter 13 says this: "But the men who had gone up with him said, 'We are not able to go up against the people, for they are too strong for us.'" You know, why all this negativism? Perhaps they thought that God had failed them in the past. And that is the reason. You know, so they were running things through their mind. And they said, we came out of the land and we didn't have water. And it was only after we complained about that God gave us water. And, we didn't have food, and so he gave us manna. But, that manna, after a while, that got old in the wilderness. And so we complained, and then finally he gave us the quail to eat. And every time that we've needed something, we've had to complain to get it, it seems like. Even in that, he brought us out here, and we already had to fight Amalek. And now he wants us to go right back and fight again. And so they in their minds, the things that they were thinking of is all the things and all the times where they thought God had failed them in the past. And they thought, perhaps he is a God who deals too severely with us. Recall when Moses came down from the mount with the commandments, that he found the children of Israel down there engrossed in all sorts of sin with the golden calf that they had put up. And that day they went through the camp and cleansed the camp. And it says that 3,000 were put to death that day. And so in their minds, they said, we're dealing with a God that's too severe here. Perhaps even his severity, he's going to even change sides on us. And he'll turn against us. And we won't be able to fight the enemy. And so they said, an invisible God is not quite as good as a visible enemy. And so we'd rather see what we could do to get ourselves from this situation. Of course, God was not sympathetic to this at all. It was a personal referendum here upon his credibility. Though he forgave their sin in response to Moses' prayer, still he saw this and God took this personally. And I don't know how else he could have taken it. Verse 27 of chapter 14 here says, "Now how long shall I bear with this evil congregation who are grumbling against me? I have heard the complaints of the sons of Israel which they are making against me." And then verse 29 there, the same chapter says, "Your corpses shall fall in this wilderness, even all your numbered men according to your complete number, from 20 years old and upward, who have grumbled against me." So there was the response. And though the nation was not wiped out, and God has suggested that to Moses on a couple occasions, that he would start a new nation just with Moses because of his faithfulness, because of Moses' intercession, the nation was not wiped out, but instead he certainly punished those who were of an unbelieving heart. And they died there in the wilderness. There is also then we see this failure that is attached to hard hearts that occurs sometimes. Hebrews, the third chapter, and verse 12. Hebrews 3:12 says, "Take care, brethren, lest there should be in any of you an evil, unbelieving heart, falling away from the living God." A doubting heart is not just a minor fault that can be overlooked by God. It is not just one failing among many. It is a source of rebellion as far as God is concerned. Now, turning back to our text there in Numbers 13, we see a second thing that happened is that they had a distorted self-image. In verse 33 then, and the last part of that verse says, "And we became like grasshoppers in our own sight, and so we were in their sight." You notice that this is the way we see ourselves, and this is the way we became in their sight. You know, is the perception that we have of ourselves the same perception that other people have of us? Well, maybe not initially. You know, maybe other people see within us qualities that we don't see ourselves, but the longer they are associated with us, they will begin to see us the same way as we see ourselves. And here is a word of caution for people who are working with young people or parents who are working with their children. The things that you tell your children are the things that they will believe. The things that you condition. If you tell your child that they are dumb and you repeat that to them often enough, they will believe that they are dumb and they will live that out. If you tell them that they're ugly or unattractive, they will believe that and they will live that out. If you indicate to them in any way, of course, they are less than they are, they will believe that for the rest of their life. If you tell them that they are a loser, they will act like one. And this is the foundation that some parents in particular give to their offspring to build upon. And all the counseling in the world after that many, many times is not able to surmount all that. And that's why a lot of times when they joke about the counseling and the psychiatrist and the such, and they say it's your mother's fault, well, it does have a lot to do with going back to what our parents have conditioned us with. And sometimes those obstacles are things that we can never overcome. And here is the perception that they had. They had a perception that they were a group of people that were grasshoppers, and that these other people were giants, and that they could not go in. It was not a real self-evaluation, of course, but it was a confession of their own unbelief, and it was an insult here to God. Why should anyone trust the Almighty when he sees himself as a grasshopper and he sees other people as giants? Now, the truth of the matter is, of course, is that Canaanites were frightened out of their wits about the possibility that the Israelites would come over and capture this land and take it. And it's revealed 38 years later in Joshua, the second chapter, Joshua 2 and verses 9 and 11 is the case where eventually they get ready to conquer the land. The spies go in. And they visit one Rahab, and she confesses this to him. She says in verse 9, "And he said to the men, 'I know that the Lord has given you the land, and that the terror of you has fallen on us, and that all the inhabitants of the land have melted away before you.'" And verse 11, "And when we heard it, our hearts melted, and no courage remained in any man any longer because of you. For the Lord your God, He is God in heaven above and on earth beneath." The grasshopper complex causes us to feel inferior. And it's like looking in a bent mirror at a carnival somewhere that distorts how we look. That it will distort how we look at ourselves. It will distort how we look at our enemies. It will distort our challenges. And it will certainly distort how we look at God. Now, a third item here about the grasshopper complex is that of double-mindedness. They were looking here for a lodestar. They were looking for someone that they could attach themselves to. They are found themselves falling into an emotional swamp here, looking and digging and finding someone who would take them in the direction that they wanted to go. You see, the part sometimes about leadership is that leadership takes you in a direction that is the right direction, but it's not necessarily the direction that the majority decides that they want to go. And that was the case here, that Moses wanted to take them over into the land and lead them into the land, but that was not what the majority wanted. They wanted someone who would act out and fulfill the role that they had in mind, which was to turn back and go back to Egypt. And we see that in 14:2. It says, "And all the sons of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron, and the whole congregation said to them, 'Would that we had died in the land of Egypt, or would that we had died in this wilderness.'" And then verse 4. "So they said to one another, 'Let us appoint a leader and return to Egypt.'" Oh, if we can just find ourselves someone who will lead us in the direction that we want. And that's really what many people want. And in looking in leadership, is somebody will lead them in the direction that they want to go. Not in the direction that is the right direction, or in the direction that expands them. But they're looking for someone who will lead them back into the comfortability, and back in the areas where they can draw up and say, "This feels better and this feels good." But certainly not in an area where I might feel vulnerable, and that things just don't feel that right. So much for the benefits of faith here that we see. They weren't looking for a leader. They were looking for a leader here for a retreat, and not only were they looking for a leader for their retreat, but they're also on the other side, they wanted to stone the optimist too. We get rid of that voice, those nagging people. I'm tired of listening to those optimists. Let's get rid of them. And so James, the first chapter and verses 6-8 tells us, of course, about the danger of being double-minded, and the penalty that we can pay there. James, the first chapter, and verses 6-8. James, first chapter, verses 6-8 says, "But let him ask in faith without any doubting. For the one who doubts is like the surf of the sea, driven and tossed by the wind. For let not that man expect that he will receive anything from the Lord, being a double-minded man, unstable in all his ways." Double-mindedness spills out into all of our life. And here we find the nation of Israel, they are poised between two events. They're poised between Egypt and Canaan. And Egypt back here, they were in slavery. And here in Canaan was this great possibility of their freedom and the claiming of the promise that had been made to the father Abraham and to Isaac and to Jacob. And that's the direction that they were being led before. But they stood between these great events, what did they choose? They chose to go back into the slavery, and they're going back into the bondage, because that's what they knew. And that's what they knew, the restrictions and the limits to all that. But boy, this idea and this concept of freedom, this concept of having to go out and claim the promises of God, that's something different entirely. And they really didn't want any part in that. You know, there comes a point in decision of all our lives as to where we're going to go with the real Word of God, whether we're going to make decisions to follow after God and be faithful and expand ourselves in that faith, or where we're going to fall back into comfortability. And they tell me about a Greek sporting event in which a Greek rider would stand on the back of two horses and put a foot on each horse, and then the horses would take off and gallop. Of course, they would not remain together for all that long, and so he had to make a decision when the horses began to separate. They had to make a decision. They made the wrong decision. But each one of us are faced with decisions that we have to make. That moment of decision comes when we have to decide where we are going to ride. An eye that shifts from God to the world will not be able to take confident steps. You see, the reason why they couldn't step out and go to the promised land, because that was an area they were looking for trailblazers. Way back to Egypt, it was marked. Their footprints were still in the sand. They could follow their way back. That way they knew. But the way ahead, knew for sure. That wasn't for them. A fourth thing is the desire for security, of course, this fear of failure that they had. They were confronted with that idea many times that they are afraid to fail. Of course, in this particular case, failure, they equated failure here as dying. They said, well, we'll just die there in the land. And certainly anything is better than death. So let's turn around and go back to Egypt. And so we see that they have this fear that they will not be able to succeed. How many fortunes have been lost because people have been afraid to step out? Been afraid to take initiatives because they're afraid to fail. They knew what they had back here, but they went out there, there was just too much uncertain. Didn't know what they might find out there. Sometimes I think when we look at a New Testament story of Peter walking on the water, you remember the story of the 12 in the boat and Jesus not with them, and the storm came up, and then they looked up and they saw Jesus walking on the water, and Peter gets out of the boat and he walks toward him. Now the discussion comes when we begin to look at that story, and when people begin to analyze it, they always focus in on Peter. Now he took his eyes off the Lord and he fell down in the water and began to sink, and the Lord had to lift him back up out of there. But I don't think we give Peter enough credit. Where were the other 11? They were back there in the safety of the boat. They didn't get out and walk across that water. They didn't take one step on that water. So where was their faith? Their faith was wrapped up in a boat and a sail and holding on for dear life. While Peter got out and walked across on the water at least a ways. You know, the only way that perhaps you can avoid failure is by not taking a chance, by playing it safe. And maybe you can call that not being a failure. But I'm not so sure. Now, fifth thing is this despising of the weakness strategy. And there, should we plan here? And should we have strategy and strength versus faith? God, you know, how would God play into this picture? You know, before we venture out, before we ever do anything, do we have to have everything planned out? Because when we do that, and I think planning is good and laying out a course of action is very good, but sometimes we do that because we want to eliminate all possibilities that we'll fail. Because somewhere we assume that failing is always bad. Not always bad. It's not always bad. But here not even the taking in the equation here is the deficiencies that God was going to make up. You see, God takes great pleasure in our weaknesses and turning them into assets for Him. And the Lord loves to use our infirmities. He really likes to use our given weaknesses that we have. And sometimes, and I think we need to all determine, the practice that doesn't happen very often is determining what our spiritual gifts are. I think we should do that. I think we ought to determine, you know, what is our one, two, or three spiritual gifts that God has given us to do and work on that. But sometimes God puts us in a position where we do have to expand ourselves, and our first response often is, I could never do that. You know, I just can't do that. Well, you know, teach a Sunday school class or get up and say something or give a prayer in a public worship service. I just can't do that. But sometimes I think God does that because He wants to take pleasure in showing what His power can do. Because we may all know that may not be your spiritual gift, but when you do it, the body is really blessed. because it comes from an unexpected source, an unexpected place. 2 Corinthians 12:10. 2 Corinthians 12:10. Second Corinthians 12:10 says, "Therefore I am well content with weaknesses, with insults, with distress, with persecutions, with difficulties for Christ's sake. For when I am weak, then I am strong." You see, God works through me to take care of the deficiencies that I have, the natural gifts that I don't have. He can do that. I can't do it on my own. I can go through all the learning courses, take all the books off the self-help shelf, and get the tapes, the audio tapes and the video tapes, and set and try to work out my character and take care of my weaknesses. But really, God can take care of that and do that for me when He calls me into His service. You know, Jacob, when he wrestled with the angel, and he was physically weak after that, and he had a limp, it tells us, for the rest of his life because it touched his hip. And, when he came back to face his brother Esau, whose birthright he had stolen, he was fearful for his life because when he came back, he knew that he would not be able to physically escape if his brother was out to kill him. But, of course, God took care of that, and it made Jacob a different man during all that. But by nature, we seldom trust God unless we have to. No. He's our last resort. When we've exhausted everything else, then we turn to God. You know, Moses said that if there was any afraid of going to battle, that they should stay home. Deuteronomy, the 20th chapter, and verses 4 and 8. He said this, Deuteronomy 20, verse 4, says, "For the Lord your God is the one who goes with you to fight for you against your enemies to save you." And then verse 8, "Then the officers shall speak further to the people, and they shall say, 'Who is the man who is afraid and faint-hearted? Let him depart and return to his house, so that he might not make his brother's hearts melt like his heart.'" If you're afraid, we don't want you in the service. We don't want you on the battlefield because fear will spread among the faithful. And they might go out there already poised for victory, and you come out there and you lead them in defeat because fear is contagious. It is contagious. And so he says, we don't want you. Just depart. You know, we have all shrunk from the will of God. We have been overwhelmed by our own insecurities and our own fears. We have been confronted with a burden that we have felt has been too heavy for any of us to bear. Because failure is an addictive thing. We seem to get some kind of adrenaline rush by constant failure. And a string of failures will cause us to cringe from the challenges of spiritual growth and victory, as it did the nation of Israel. Now, throughout this series, of course, we've been awfully critical, perhaps, upon the nation of Israel. And our intent is not to be critical upon them, but to show that their spiritual journey is our spiritual journey. Areas where they failed, we failed too. And if only we could learn from the spiritual lessons that they went through so that we would not have to go through them. Well, my question before you this morning is to think about the territory that God may want you to inherit. And about the walled cities that are standing in your way. The giants in your eye that you see that are across the river. And are you going to then allow these things to stand between you and your inheritance? are you going to claim what God said is yours? The decision is up to you whether you cross over